sent me your responses. If you haven't sent them, please do send them. Or hand them to me. Hand them to me after class, okay? Okay. So let's talk about some laws here. Start with the laws of Eshluna. If you want to see, by the way, I believe this list is culled from, there's a two-volume set. You can probably get it. If you have any interest in ancient Near East, there's a two-volume set of texts and pictures and things like that from the ancient Near East, edited by James Pritchard. As in pitch with an R before that, A-R-D at the end. Okay, Pritchard. And if you want to get it, what's that? Really? I don't. You know, I don't. That's about. They picked that name? That's weird. Okay. Anyway, so Pritchard's volumes on ancient Near Eastern texts. You can probably get them on half.com relatively inexpensively, because in many college courses elsewhere and other universities, it's sort of a required text. So you can get people usually for selling for a couple of bucks their, you know, their volumes. There's one and two. There's one's orange and one is blue. Okay. So if you have any interest in doing any of this stuff, you might. It's a very inexpensive investment. Yes. So you go to the computer and you print it out. Okay. That really bothers me, though, I have to say. Okay. And while I'm at it, I'll just state that I'm sure none of you, but for the first time in my life, I screamed at a student who decided that the ledge in the stairwell was a place for putting his empty bottle down. Okay. So it ranks among the offenses against Kavra Brios. I pointed out to him that it wasn't the garbage. Okay, anyway. So, in fact, if everybody did that, it might temporarily raise the obnoxious tone a tad, but it would make for a lot more pleasant place to live in. Okay. And in laws of Eshluna, Mr. Weinstein, why don't you read some? Okay. Number 13. Yeah, you don't have them? Is that what you have? Read. 13.
Which one? 13?
Yeah.
The man who is born in the house of a ranking citizen in that house during the daytime shall pay 10 shekels of silver. He who is
born in
the house shall die.
Whoa, what's going on here? It sounds a lot like Baba Machteres. Okay. Now, the question here, so if he's caught during the day, he pays a fine. If caught at night, he gets put to death. Now, what is striking about this, yeah?
It's just interesting. You shall not get away alive. Even if he's turning to run away. Which is
okay. Which suggests what? Yeah.
I think Greenberg said this, but Baba Machteres isn't a punishment. Self-defense. It's not like if he does that.
Is this self-defense here?
It's not like it would be a punishment. Shall not get away.
Okay, so before you jump to that conclusion, for those who are interested in Lumdus, if you learn the Sugyas and Pensora and Mora that deal with Baba Machteres, you will actually see that there's a very strong element of Onesh Beis Din involved. Just as one example, the principle of Kamle B'Dirabamine, which is applied to a Baba Machteres, does not apply we paskin against, I think, Rav Nachunya ben Akana Shita by Kares and by Onshim Bidei Shamayim. We paskin only applies when Beis Din administers an onesh. If you eat somebody's food on Yom Kippur, so in the process you incur an obligation to pay money and you incur Kares, assuming there's no malchus actually administered, so you chayiv to pay. We don't say Kamle B'Dirabamine. By that token, you should not have said "Kam lebi the rabbi by Baba Machteres who got away." Okay, if you killed the guy, fine. So you say he's pata from paying. But if he didn't get away, you should say that he's chayav to pay. The Gemara says that he's pata. Shiber Kalin, so he's pata by Baba Machteres. That is one of any number of suggestions that are or possible hints in the sugya that there's an element of onesh based in, almost as if the balabayas is a shaliach based in an acting. But putting that aside, it's clear in halacha it's only permitted when it's in self-defense. From here, it sounds as if there's a clear distinction drawn between day and night, not a question of self-defense. Now, there is a funny shitas harayvet about this. If you actually look, you know, the Rambam assumes the classic assumption is that day and night is just dibur hakasuv behoveh. Right? In the way Chazal read in Zorcha Hashemesh Alav, it's in Baruch Lecha Hadavar Kishemesh. Even the sheet of the Raivir may only be that during the Chiddush of the Torah by Baba Machteres. How is Baba Machteres different than a Rodef? How do you... this is very, very important. Well, you don't have to know, what do you mean? What you're saying is correct, but you have to sort of just elaborate a little bit. The makor by Rodef is from Nara Hamarasa. Okay? The assumption by Rodef is that there has to be a presumption. That you have to, in a sense, know the person is coming to kill you. And there has to be a certain degree of vada'us. Not to raise a thorny political issue, not in America, but in the Israel situation, those people who applied the term of Rodef, and this fringe group of people, to the late Prime Minister Rabin, were people who simply distorted halacha for their own purposes. Meaning a person to be a Rodef has to be in the clear circumstances. The intent isn't always necessary, but the effects have to be clear. And killing the person has to also have the same clearly desired effect. Baba Machteres is not so. Baba Machteres means that when a guy breaks into your basement at night, there is a presumption, even without knowing any details, even without talking to him, even without witnessing any malicious intent on his part, merely by virtue of the fact that he broke in, that you are allowed to kill him. Now Chazal say that there are exceptions. In other words, when it's clear to you, he wouldn't kill you if you confront him. Okay, such as Av Alabain, meaning if the father's breaking, it's strange. The father's breaking in to rob his child, but he wouldn't kill him. Okay, that's not unreasonable. So in such a case, then you're not allowed to kill him. So the Ravid may extend that a bit to the day, changing the issue of presumption. But the principle, clearly in Chazal, the way they understood it, is very clearly one of basically self-defense. It's not a monetary crime. Even the way the Torah formulated it, it's in Imam Achteresi Matse Hagana V'hukav Ames. In other words, if you kill him, so then he's exempt. Then you're exempt from doing so. But in Zerach Hashem Hashalav Damim Lo, it's simply a presumption of what the person has. Now, one can debate what the law is here exactly in the laws of Eshuna, but here it may be that simply the coming in at night is considered a capital crime, which is even though there's no intent to kill. Now, this might seem surprising to you until we see later in other laws, later but not so much later in Hammurabi, that there are monetary crimes which are punished by death. And that has to do with the question of the slaves and different classes of people. Probably in the house of a slave, they might not have administered the same penalty. The Torah, by the way, does draw a distinction, but only one distinction between a free person and a slave.
Sure.
That's by monetary payment, but in terms of capital issues, right? In other words, the difference between an eved, by the way, an eved and a free person is simply the amount, and it's not always l'chumra. Sometimes it's l'kula. In other words, it goes both ways. It's a fixed fine by an eved. It's a kofar by a free person. But the only distinction in terms of the life, and the shor is killed either way, the only difference between a free person and an eved in terms of life comes in one area, which I'll mention now because it's a fascinating, I don't know if this is the right section in the course to raise it. What's that? Eved Kanani. Eved Ivri, there's no difference between Eved Ivri and Ben Chorin. There's maybe one difference in Isser V'Hetta with an Eved Ivri and a free Jew, an Amma, a Shivcha Kananis, and that's it. Yomo Yomayim. What's Yomo Yomayim?
If you strike,
the Torah says if you strike your Eved or Shivcha, your Amma, with a rod, and they die, so you get killed. Nakom yinakem. But achim yomo yomayim. Odlo yukam ki chaspohu. That if he survives for 24 hours, you don't... if he survives for a day or two, which Chazal understood to be 24 hours, meis leis, so you don't kill the master. That's the only case. But now, what's very interesting is there's a comment that the Rashbam has there. The Rashbam says that this is only true if you strike him with a shevet. If you strike him with a cherev, even if he survives for a few days, you're chayiv misa. Why? The intent to kill. What's even more fascinating is the Rambam in Hilchos Ratzeach Ushmiyas Nefesh, I believe it's in Perek Beis, writes, Yeroy Ali, that if the owner struck his eved, that this din only applies when the owner strikes his eved with a shevet. If he strikes him with a cherev, so the Rambam says he's chayiv misa. even if he survives. The Rashbam saying what he says isn't so surprising. The Rashbam says lots of things, even which are against halacha, to say something which the halacha doesn't explicitly address, so it's not surprising. The fact that the Rambam writes that in the Mishnah Torah is very interesting. So anyway, generally we don't really draw a distinction in terms of the value, the shivyon nefesh of an eved versus a free person. Okay. Now, Fifty-four. Go ahead. One more. Says. What words are popping in your head? The imshar nagachu mitmol shoshom. Are we surprised? No, we're not surprised to see this here. Why should we be surprised? Why am I not surprised? Because in societies that have oxen, so. Unless you believe in the Shtanu Hatzvayim, and there's no reason to believe that here, neither the Chazal say that, oxen gore. And when oxen gore, they sometimes kill people. When they kill people, you have to deal with an ox that is gored. Right? And you have oxen that gore on rare occasions because the stars were aligned wrong, and you have oxen which gore regularly because they like the gore. Like you have man-eating tigers. Right? So I'm not surprised if I saw a scenario if the Torah speaks about oxen, but the Code of the Hammurabi speaks about cars, I'd be a little surprised. When they both speak about oxen and they both speak about similar scenarios, well, why are you surprised? Right? You shouldn't be surprised. You expect the same scenarios to come up. Now, the similarities are often not as important as the differences. The differences are often highlight. Sometimes the laws of the Torah are the same. Sometimes they're different, and the differences often can clue us in to fundamental to difference in the philosophical underpinnings of the law, which is very important. That's what Greenberg's article is all about. Okay, so but you expect the cases to be the same. Maybe the answer in the multiple, maybe the answer you circle in the multiple choice is different between Hammurabi and Lahavdil Parshas Mishpatim. But the bottom line is you expect a lot of things initially at first glance to look similar. Okay, so what happens? And the authorities have brought the fact to knowledge of man. Who ad divalov? And the next line is, but okay, he does not have his ox dehorned. And I said this to my shir, but I had a disagreement with a student of mine last year at intro with oxen. He was from Wisconsin. Okay, now I don't know that he actually grew up on a farm or anything like that, but he claimed that cows do not have horns, only bulls do. Okay, and anybody who blinks that he's correct, and I thought that wasn't so, but I wasn't going to argue with someone who grew up much closer to many cows than I did. So I only tell you anybody who would like to verify from my trip to a local zoo with my camera in hand, not for that reason, but it was just an opportunity. I will be happy to show you on my computer that in fact cows do have horns. Okay, so this could be a cow or an ox, but either way. In fact, there's a Mishnah, no? Shor shenagach hapara, and then you have the reverse case, a parah shenagach hashor. So what was he talking about? They knew. Okay, anyway. So cows have horns. So if an ox gores, and he doesn't have his ox to dehorn, now that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah?
I'm just curious how much normal is covered in the Mishnah.
I don't know. I don't know how much that is, in the equivalent. Yeah, it is. It's probably the same Semitic root as mana, is my guess. In fact, I don't know how. The mina is probably, it's probably an Akkadian pronunciation, so probably is. It's not the translator's pronunciation. All right. So then so if the cause gores a man and causes his death, okay, then. Go ahead.
The owner shall pay 2/3 of the mana.
All right, now, two interesting things here. Firstly, what is not said? The animal should be put to death. In the second? Okay, so the truth is that, and it's interesting, how did Chazal understand the Gambal of Yumas? Kofar. What's that? Well, no, the Pasuk says, in Kofar Yushas Allah. Without Chazal's understanding, you would read it as an either or. Like in Saudi Arabia, right? And you kill somebody. You know, here, depending upon the family, they can decide whether to have you killed or, you know, to accept the ransom or whatever else, right? Now, in a sense, and I say this not as an anti-Islamic comment, but that mode of thought and law, we would say is extremely religiously or theologically or philosophically primitive. Now, there was one other interesting aspect is the ox is dehorned. What is the range within Chazal? What the Chazal understand what Shmira means? One version is to tie it up. Rabbi Eliezer says Ein Shmira Lebesakin, which interestingly enough, the Septuagint seems to have had a text which read Not Velo Yishmirenu Be'alav, but Velo Yishmidenu Be'alav. So there seem to be all sorts of that. It could be exegetical, it could be textual, whatever. It wouldn't be the first textual variant if it was what underlay the Septuagint. Either way, there seem to be a lot of different solutions how to understand how you solve the problem. In this case, you dehorn the ox. An ox can still be pretty dangerous even without horns. But
it could be an expression. Dehorn means you take out its power, and that's generally what the short. How do I call it?
I don't. I think it means you cut the horns off. You cut the horns off, right? You don't kiff the kid. What's that? Yeah, why not? You remove the offending organs. That's all. It could run somebody. It could roll over on somebody. I understand. But the typical way, is trained. I'm sorry? Okay, that is, understand that that is a theoretical, fictitious case. I don't think that ever happened. It doesn't decide, that's not its horn, it takes a horn. It's the opening sugya in Balakam, I think, no? Yeah, that's a theoretical case. That's one of those cases where you look at and you realize that not every case Chazal discussed has actually happened. Okay? I'm sorry? When it picks a horn up in its mouth, right? Okay, it's for theoretical purposes only. I'm just pointing that I take the horn to be literal, but yeah. Yes, so. Okay, but here it doesn't talk about having killed first either. That's a question of whether or not if you gore and damage, whether or not you establish mu'ad la'adam also. Okay. So now, the one that interests me the most, though, is the absence of killing the shor. Why? No, but why in the laws of Shmuel don't they do that? Yeah.
What the article's talking about, that property was so valuable that they didn't want to require you to kill the
shor. Well, I think it's there's something more than that also.
They didn't view what it is, so bad.
Right. Now, the question is the value of human life. The fact that it can be compensated with money is significant. Does the Torah allow human life to be compensated with money? No. Only by Shor Shenagach. That's the only case, and that's because you didn't kill. The ox, by the way, has no ransom. You can't ransom the ox. The ox gets put to death. It's the owner who bears some indirect responsibility who's allowed to pay. And the way Chazal understood, which is really just taking an effect where the Torah was already going, and Chazal understood it to mean command, and it wasn't that you could die if your ox killed and you had a choice whether to ransom yourself. There's no such thing as killing a person, but the Torah in Parshas Maaseh is very clear, both for Shogeg and for Mezid. Now in the ancient Near East that wasn't so, and Greenberg has a lot to say about that. His basic thesis is that in this regard, I'm not going to speak about it at length. It's a different shiur that I've occasionally given about non-literal interpretation of scripture and how one reads the story, certainly of Bereishis, of the creation story, assuming that you don't buy into Lubavitcher Rebbe's belief that the world is only 57 and however many years old. I assume most people, either they haven't thought about it or they believe in the dinosaurs, but they haven't quite reconciled that with the age of the world. So you've heard all sorts of theories and so on. I'll only comment probably most of the Rishonim, in light of today's knowledge, would probably have opted for a non-literal reading of the first parak of Bereishis, or maybe minimally. And if that's the case, then you have to ask, what is the message of the first parak of Bereishis? Are there people here who... Well, I'm not going to ask that question. I'm afraid we'll be here with the answers. On that assumption, what is the message of the first parak of Bereishis? And Greenberg's thesis is the centrality of man in creation. I think this is really probably, if there were a 14th Iker that could be added to the Torah, to the Rambam's Ikarim, I would have added this as the 14th Iker. And you would think that's crazy, but in light of I don't think anybody's going to get an amendment passed, but it's a good idea, not a good idea. You know, to ban gay marriage in this country, but if people were hachamim einehem parashehem, they would pass an amendment to make clear that only humans are given rights in this country and not animals, because there are lunatics in the courts, you know, trying to create rights for animals and bringing lawsuits on behalf of chimpanzees and other animals. And the only way to stop that would be at a time... What's that? Correct. What that does is that degrades human life. It doesn't ennoble animal life. And now is the time to do it, since 98% of this country would view these people as nutcases. Now's the time to do it before their poison and pernicious beliefs seep in, you know, into the mainstream culture, and it becomes more difficult to do it. You can shut the door closed now. Yes, Ayo.
That's exactly what you do when you kill a shore. You're saying that a shore is equal to man.
No. The point is, I think Chazal pick up on this point in Sanhedrin about a, you know, Shor Shirava, which is because Basa Takala La Adam Al Yado is the reason why you eliminate things. In other words, you're not killing the shore because it's equal to a because the shore is treated like a human being. You're killing the shore because anything that kills a human being gets killed. Because if you kill a shore, do you get killed?
No.
That's the point. It's not the perpetrator, it's the victim that matters. Any being that's responsible for the death of a human being is punished. What's that? But that argument could be made. If an animal is dangerous, you can learn the sugyas in the first parak in Sanhedrin with Rabbi Eliezer, kol hakodem lahor ganzacha. That's a separate issue. That's not a death penalty. That's just siluk nezek. That's like makah. But the point is that killing a shor shenagah is not a question of simply removing the hezek. If that were the case, you wouldn't require 23 dayanim. You wouldn't require any of those things. You don't kill a mu'ad animal if it only causes property damage. But it's mu'ad, and it's likely to kill somebody. No. A shor is only killed given the death penalty when it kills a human being. So I understand that it seems to be, what do they say, in loco homo sapiens, but it's really not. It's not the thing that killed, it's the fact that the tzelem elokim was destroyed, or was, you know, the person was killed by the shore. Okay. Now, I think, by the way, that message is driven home not only, I don't know if Greenberg says this, not only in the centrality of man in creation, especially, what does he contrast it with? With the ancient Near Eastern vision of man as being created to serve the needs of the gods, and the gods are sort of the center, and therefore man and animals are basically all on the same plane. I think the other point in the Torah that drives this home, anyone know? This idea of the problem with allowing animals to be too close to man in terms of status? Why after the Mabul? Before the pre-Mabul, they weren't allowed to kill animals, to eat them. Right? Post-Mabul, so they were given the animals to eat. I think, again, the same message is being driven home, which is that the pinnacle and the center and the focus of creation is man. Animals don't have any rights. Animals, the way Rashi is, the famous Rashi, it's probably Bereishis Rabba, why did God destroy the animals in the flood? So one teretz is that Kishis Kolbasaras Darkala, or it's even the animals were Makalka, whatever that means. And the second approach in the Medrash is that animals were only created for the purposes of man. If there are no men, there's no need for animals either. Okay. I'm sorry? I'm interested in social commentary, so I'm going to refrain from commenting. Yes. The answer to that question is that if that's how God chose to create his world, so that's his business, not for us to tell him how. Right? I'm not dismissing the question. I'm not dismissing the question. I'm just saying the answer, you know, the answer to you know, those who have some people have serious problems with evolution. Now, I'm not a scientist, although many good scientists that I know will tell you that the evidence, for the most part, is overwhelming. I've only pointed out that evolution doesn't present any problems for Jewish philosophy. As far as I'm concerned, it's not for us to tell God how to create his world, and if he thought this was the wisest way to bring about the existence of humankind and then to bring us to Har Sinai, I have no problems with that. And as far as reading of these stories and brachas are concerned, Rishonim dealt with similar types of problems, not the same scientific problems, and they had no problems reinterpreting. So if need be, we could do the same thing. Okay. Anyway, fine. So that's one major point of Greenberg, is that the centrality of human beings in the creation. Now, the other thing that's starting to come up, let's go to 6, Hammurabi. Let's take another volunteer, Mordechai.
If a free man stole the property of the church of state, the man should be possessed. Also, the one who is given the man should be possessed.
Okay. They must have been a Republican. Okay. Now, that's a joke. What's that? I'll tell you after class. I'm sorry? Well, that's a good connection. What's the punishment for Me'ila? That's only about B'shogeg. Karen Chomish is only B'shogeg. He doesn't mean Me'ila, he means stealing from Hekdesh. What happens if you steal from Me'ezes? There are two positions among the Tanoim. No Kares. One position is the Lav. That's the mainstream position. There is a Shita of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Is he a Misa Bidei Shemayim? Someone just said that. Misa Bidei Shemayim. However, there is no death penalty, even from stealing Hekdesh. However, there is a tradition within Chazal. What about someone who's Gonev Es Akasva? It's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. In the 10th parak, I believe. 9th or 10th, in the 9th or 10th parak. Kasva, it's assumed to be like a beam of Hekdesh or something like that. It's one of the three things that Kanoin Pogim, though. It's kind of interesting. Okay? I think Kohen Shishime, Zar Shishimish, or Kohen Shishimish Betuma, and Balaramis Beshuk, and Gonir Sakasva, so Kanaim Pogimbo. I'm sorry? End of the ninth prayer. So you really don't have such thing in Chazal, in the Torah. Take a look at number 7. Now notice the fence also gets put to death. That's a good thing, by the way. If you got rid of the chop shops, there would be almost no car thieves. Okay? Very appropriate for this neighborhood. Question 7. Law 7. Whoever was reading for me. Yeah, I'm sorry. I got it.
Either silver or gold or a male slave or an ox or a sheep or an ass or any sort of thing from the hand of a man's son or a man's slave without the decision contract.
There's a very interesting twist here. You need to have a witness or a contract. It's the person who takes it from someone who's not its owner. So basically, in effect, he may be buying stolen goods, so he gets the death penalty. Now notice, without witnesses or contracts, we say you're not allowed to lend money without a contract or witnesses, but that's because of lifnei iver. Here it's a question of it doesn't establish rightful ownership. In other words, if you buy something when the person selling it to you is willing to have witnesses or willing to write a contract, what does that mean? You're entitled to presume that it's really his, but if he doesn't have those things, then you should assume he's a thief, and you're a thief. Okay. Now here again, the notion that monetary crimes can get the death penalty. This is unheard of in the Torah. The only example that's typically raised is the Bava Matzaris, which is really not a clearly the Torah's view is certainly not a monetary crime. It's not the monetary crime which drives the punishment. And there really are no other examples of that. Yeah.
I know we didn't get to number 8 just yet, but isn't it contradictory the fact that if we're killing him because he's concerned with his thief, isn't that man that he shall be put to death? And the next case, which actually talking about a real thief, it says he can't make restitution, and if he has money, then he dies. So why did this thief, number 7, immediately get that?
Let me ask you a question. What are you supposed to do with the Korban Pesach? What does the Torah say? How do you eat it? Al toch lemenuna umashom shayim ki im tzli esh. Okay, what does the Torah say in Parashas Devarim? What do you do with the Korban Pesach? Uvishalta v'yochalta. Yeah, ayo, you know the pasuk to Reyam too. Okay, yes. So what's the answer? So you have one of two possibilities, one of which we consider unacceptable, which is to say, well, you have two sources. That would be acceptable in the case of the Hammurabi, that might be, although not necessarily. I say that as a segue, because what do you do in the Torah? So you already see that the Machaber Sefer Divrei Hayamim writes Vayivashlu Es HaPesach Ba'esh. It's one of the earliest examples that can be clearly demonstrated of biblical exegesis of resolving two psukim that are seemingly contradictory into a non-contradiction. Okay, I haven't quoted that this year before on Torah Shu'al Peh. Albeck mentions this example in his Mavo LaMishnah. Anyway, so you can do the same thing here. So you can say in one case it didn't spell out what it spelled out in the other. I'll give you another classic example. But there's no resolving pasuk, because I'll make the resolution. When does an Eved Kanani who's near Tzad go free? Avadol Le'olam. Yet another pasuk says that in Yovel they go free. So the answer is you put together something, you have resolution with psukim somehow. Okay. Fine. So one of those two solutions, when it comes to Hammurabi, we can posit source criticism if we like. But that has to assume that the code was simply compiled from various previous laws which may have contradicted one another. I will tell you, my intuition tells me that our sense of how you write a law code differs than how the ancients wrote a law code. And since the Torah is written, at least from a superficial perspective, Dibra Torah Kalashim B'nei Adam, it should not surprise us to see contradictions in between different psukim in the Torah. And that should not be, from a purely intellectual perspective, it may be taken as a logical contradiction, but it's not an indication of separate, of multiple authorship. And however the process a judge was supposed to do once upon a time, that is, if you were a judge in Hammurabi society, if your job was to choose between the laws, or to make a pshara between the two laws, or whatever it was, and you give a teretz like the Balei HaTosfos would, I don't know what their conventions were, but whatever you're supposed to do, that's what you're supposed to do with an ancient law code. Okay, I don't know exactly what that is. Chazal have an approach also. Yeah. No. What I'm saying is, it may be the way, when I say Lashon B'nei Adam, I mean even the literary genre, a literary style. No, that's something else. But what I'm saying is, we think you write a law code in a certain fashion. Like, there should be no contradictions in a law code. Okay? That's, by the way, not exactly true either. The Constitution, I don't know if you'd say there's any explicit contradictions, but many cases hinge upon balancing different, rights of the Constitution. Right? No rights are absolute, because frequently one right conflicts with another right. Now, the contradiction may not be as explicit, but we have a sense you write a law code, there should be no spheres between the law code, so when the judge needs to apply the law, he looks in, section 25, part A, subsection 1, and he sees what the law is when you make a right hand on red between the hours of 12 and 3 on a New York City intersection. Right? If there's a contradiction there, he's got a problem. What does he do? Well, he probably doesn't know what to do, but it may have been that the way in ancient Near East, it may have been law codes were written differently. In other words, they were sometimes had contradictory scenarios, and a judge was supposed to do something with it. I don't know what that was. I don't live back then. And in a pshat level, that's the way the Torah is supposed to be understood as well. But it's not that having contradicting laws is an indication of multiple sources. That's the way law was done. That's what I mean when I say Dibra Torah Kol Shmei Adam, that the literary genre of legal material in the Torah may be similar to that of the literary genre of legal material found in the ancient Near East. In the same way that we're going to see later a little bit, the poetry, of in Tanakh in many ways, echoes certain the formalistic structures of poetry are very similar to that of the Ugaritic myth, right? Because that's the way people wrote poetry in the ancient Near East. That's, you know, if a Navi decided to express his words in poetry, well, how did he write poetry? Well, presumably he learned to write poetry by listening to poetry. And I presume that Jewish poetry of the 10th century, at least in terms of its superficial characteristics, probably sounded, not necessarily the content, sounded a lot like Ugaritic poetry or Canaanite poetry of the 10th century. That's the way it is. You know, we don't, if you look at poetry written today in Israel, you look at poetry of the medievals. Anybody here taking medieval Jewish history? No medievalists here. Okay. So you take study the poetry of medieval Jewish history. Well, it looks a lot like the same kind of poetry the Arabs, you know, the Muslims were writing. Because how do you write, you want, you know, the content, I mean, some of the content doesn't deserve to be mentioned either. Even some very well-known figures, like Rabbi Dalevi. But putting that aside, assuming for the moment the content were really different, okay? Assuming the content were different, you expect that the types of rhyme and meter are going to be the same as Arabic poetry. Okay, that's the way it is. Okay. So that's what I mean by literary genre of a legal document, of a legal text. Okay, so this good question, what do you do with the contradiction? The answer is we move on. Okay. Let's skip a little bit to... Let's see, 25. Well, no, because firstly you have to demonstrate this, but though, and when we read the words Adayom Hazeh, the simple meaning is up until this day. But you don't say up until this day. Listen, that, maybe that's the terrace, that's fine, but in other words, it's not as if, in other words, if you wanted to demonstrate that, what you need to do is find a text in Tanakh or not in Tanakh, where we know when the text was written, and it says Adayom Hazeh, even though it was 2 days after the event happened, right? Then you could argue that's a convention. In effect, that's what the answer that the Rishonim are going to give anyway. That Adayom Hazeh is, I don't know, we call it predictive, but it will be that way for a long time, which is that becomes just a way of speaking. Okay. But here, what we're saying here is that you see a law code separate from the Torah, using a similar convention.
And also, if we think that Hashem dictated
for the simple reason that even though it's dictated, you know, mila, it was given by Lashon Pnei Adam. When God chose to write His Torah, He chose to write it in biblical Hebrew of the 15th century, or 14th century, whatever it is, not in another language, right? Because that's what the Jews spoke, but it was meant to be read by Jews in the 14th or 15th century, at least in its initial run. It had to make sense to them, right? Unless Adayom Hazeh, you could demonstrate, meant that wouldn't make any sense, God writing that way, for people who were going to read a document. As we read, when we study Torah, we study it with a sort of dual purpose in mind. We believe in the divinity and the kedusha of the document. At the same time, we do read a text and we translate a text and we apply rules of grammar to a text. We seek to, the first step towards meaning is reading what the text says. And the eyes through which we read the text are human eyes. We don't have any other choices. Okay. 21. Actually, 21. And Mordechai, keep going. Very interesting. Kind of, I guess the mob must have read this, except for I don't know if they killed them first. They probably do kill them first and then put them in the cement. Okay, so here you go. Here we have a mukkah for mafia killings, okay? But this was judicially sanctioned. Does this remind you of anything? Good, I like that. I think it's just an incidental connection. I think it's an incidental connection, but the famous medrash, it was about the child, you know, the medrash of the child Moshe saved. It turned out to be Micha Pesel Micha, right? So anyway, it struck me, but again, that may have just been a common image. Okay. There is an idea of poetic justice. It's not quite me the connect meter, but it's similar. Yeah.
It seems to be the theme.
An eye for an eye?
Yeah.
Mida is a very ancient concept. Does that mean that the Torah, to the extent that it applies a divar from the ancient Near East, Well, the truth is, that's the way most people think intuitively. I think. I mean, it's hard to know because when you grow up. Well, that's why I think it's intuitive. Well, that's the way God created the world.
Is that intuitive for people?
I think so.
Mita
Kenegan Mita sounds like perfectly reasonable to me. Can you think of, would you rather Mita Shalom Kenegan Mita?
It doesn't say that the head shall judge Mita Kenegan Mita. It says that it seems to be that Allah is the way God's justice works.
Right, but the point is that's how we also, nefesh tachas nefesh is Mita Kenegan Mita. Most of, you know, when you damage, you have to pay for it. That's a kind of mida kenegan mida. I mean, mida kenegan mida, doing things with, you know, everything is the mida, in effect. So some things you get a little more poetic. This mida kenegan mida is poetic justice, not just justice. That's, I think, a very intuitive human sense. Right? You would say if you were to kill a person for lighting a house on fire, it's not exactly what goes on in the next one. So intuitively, what you do is you throw them into the fire. Right? That would be, you know, you make your bed, you sleep in it. That would be, I think, just intuitive. So you don't be surprised to find that both in the ancient Near East and the Torah, it doesn't always have to, not everything that's similar is a sign of borrowing. Many times it's just a common intuition. Yeah?
In terms of 21, I just don't understand what's going on there. I make a hole in somebody else's house,
to break in, presumably, and you're caught, so they're going to put you to death. They put you to death in front of the breach, and then while you're... What's that?
The house is probably a bit
I don't know if it's. I don't think this is magic. I don't think that's what this is about. I don't think so. 25 is a little interesting, also, just because you should think about if you learn Shabbos, you know, Kol Tishrei, and what you might see on that. All right.
Why is it exactly magic? It's saying basically that I'm not sure why he is dying for, but they're saying that since he made that hole in the house, therefore his own body's going to fill that hole.
My assumption, although I don't know enough, I don't know if we know enough, is that it meant if you were breaking in to steal or something like that. Not magic stuff.
But then why specifically?
Because the way you broke in to steal was by breaking a wall into the house. So this is the scene of your crime. We kill you here, and we have to fix the hole. But I don't think it's. I don't know. I don't want to get bogged down in this. I don't know if it's. I don't think this is the Isser Mazik. This is the Isser Baba Maseres. I believe so. Yeah. Yeah.
This is actually still talking about Bhagavad Gita, so there shouldn't be previous,
Before we would do that, we'd have to sit down and read through everything systematically to discern what the structure is. I haven't done that, and I'm not going to do that right now. But then you can ask the questions. Question 116 and 129. Was it? Actually, you're right, it was. David, read 116 and 129.
The pleasure and died from beating or abuse in the house of his trainer, the owner of the place shall prove it against his merchant. And if it were the man's son, they shall put his son to death.
Wow.
If it was the man's slave, he shall pay 1/3 mina of silver and all the force of everything else that he lends.
That's pretty wild. The first part. A person kills somebody's son, so you kill his son. Now, again, this is one of the assumptions of ancient Eastern law, that children, in effect, and spouses were the property of the husband / father. Something which is obviously completely abhorrent to the Torah. That's why the pasuk says, "Lo yumsu avos abanim uvanim lo yumsu avos ish b'cheto yumasik." There are a couple of notable exceptions in Tanakh, but they are exceptions, and in a sense, al pi al gvura, not legal exceptions.
So there are cases where you pay the father of a child, a girl who's raped,
so someone answer that question.
That's because he now lost the chance to sell it to give her contribution.
The father has an economic right of marrying off a daughter, and the financial gain accrues to him, and therefore, when the person is raped, they are basically. Cost him as he pays the money.
Right.
If a girl is a bogeres, all payments of money go to her.
No, right. But even that, the fact that the father has the right for some sort of money to be made from the daughter, or some sort of money.
So, No, but the point is that I think the natural assumption was that the father had certain responsibilities for the daughter, and this was financial compensation for it. He has a responsibility of marrying her off. It's not just that, it's not a privilege necessarily, it's a responsibility.
So is it a compensation
that... An effect, I think so, yeah. In fact, is once she reaches a certain age, she's failed to fulfill that obligation, she's now on her own.
Okay.
You know, both rights and responsibilities. Yeah. I'm sorry. So that, okay. For the... Yeah, well, it doesn't work perfectly, though. There are some problems. In other words, if she earns beyond her food, say a wife who earns beyond her food can say, in his own espaniosa. She can say, I have my own bank account, I'll pay for my own stuff, my money's mine. And the husband doesn't own her masya dayim, whereas the daughter can't do that. It may be because once the din d'oraisa is set in place, the Torah did not want it to be an institution that could be broken. But so the question is a little bit, but it's a much weaker question. The notion of having control over the life of a child is foreign. Yeah.
Would a child ever grow out of being the property of the father?
I don't know, but I presume yes. I don't know what exactly the line was. I suspect that if it's not spelled out anywhere in the Code of the Hammurabi, it's because everybody knew what it was. Yeah.
It sounds like a deterrent also, very much that you'd be very careful not to cause harm to somebody else's son if you knew the same thing was going to happen to your son.
That may be true, but it's a perverse punishment. Yeah, that's true. It's true, but it still entails vicarious punishment, which is very, very problematic. Now, where do you find vicarious punishment in Tanakh? One clear-cut case. What's that? Achan's the not clear one. Chazal didn't read it that way, even though the pshat is that way. By Achan, when Achan stole from the Cherem, so it says that they took up him, his wife, his children. So Chazal say they took the wife and the children to watch. The pshuto shemikra is that they killed his family as well. The other more explicit case, yeah. What's that? No, see, we can't talk... I sort of always state this on the outset. I better not get fooled by that clock. That clock is... It was running ahead of us when we started class, now it's running behind us. Not running. So Korach, there is a stira in the Torah regarding Loyum Savas Abanim and Poker Avanavas Abanim. Now, Chazal, the truth is, Chazal resolved the problem... The Chazal were bothered by a philosophical problem. They didn't really solve the problem. It looks like they did, but they didn't. Chazal, what did Chazal say? What's Chazal's resolution?
I don't. That's
one of the. It's a very famous pasuk in Malachim, which is quoted. It's rare you get something quoted verbatim from the Torah. It's an important pasuk because the Rif cites this. It's a very famous tshuva of the Rashba about Mekadesh B'Psula Eidus the Rabbanan, the Rif, I think, quotes this pasuk as a raya to the meaning, what the Pshuta Shomikro of Layum Su'avas Abanim is. It's very interesting that this pasuk is quoted, but that's not the main. I never heard of this medrash. There is a men to Gemara and Brachos that three things Moshe did without a Kaddish Baruch Hu's permission, v'skima daito. This is not one of them.
So
it must be a different medrash then. But that's not Chazal's. The classically known resolution is... Yeah, but Ochis Ochsemachse v'sem yadem. Of course, you realize, while that solves the textual problem, it doesn't solve the philosophical problem at all. If a person is a Russian, is Oches Masa Avasavim B'yadav, so good, he deserves to be punished, but for his own sins, not for his father's sins. It doesn't really solve any of the theological problems. Now, maybe he makes the problem worse, but at least he doesn't attempt to solve it. What is Pshuto Shel Mikra? The Rashbam says that. I think Rashbam or Ibn Ezra both say this. Yeah? Absolutely correct. Lo Yumsu Avos Abanim is a statement to Beis Din, to be put to death. Pokein Avon Avos Abanim is referring to God. So Korach, therefore, is not really an exception to the rule of vicarious punishment because God punishes. Chazal assume that also, that when it comes to Bavon Nedarim Banim Esim, Chazal assume that very small children somehow will be Nenash Bavon Avosa. It's theologically disturbing, but that's the way it is. I mean, that's the way Chazal presents it, certainly. Yeah.
Do you think it's possible that the Torah wants us to see it as a development, as like presenting the status quo and then
I wouldn't rule out that methodologically, but I think that the psukim say two different things. I don't think it's really a contradiction. I think the point is that God can mete out a certain kind of justice that human beings cannot. So I methodologically, it's a very good suggestion. I just don't think it's necessary to solve this problem. Okay, now, what's the other one? The explicit one is Shul, with the Givenites. Okay, look at Malachim Shmuel Beis Perachaf Aleph, I think. Okay, where David ends up handing over seven members of the house of Shaul to the Givenites guild. That seems to have been not explicit in the Pasuk, but Chazal understood it that way, and it does seem to be there that was Alpi Hagvura. Okay, anyway, let's take a look at 129, is a really interesting one. Okay, David, read that, and then we'll move on to time to move on to Agadah. Go ahead.
If the wife of a man has been caught lying with another man, they shall bind them and throw them into the water. I assume we have to walk to get a
beast. No, if you bind somebody, you don't need to put weights on them.
They'll drown.
They can't swim. You tie it up. That's usually after they're dead. No, I'm serious. I mean, if you put somebody in the water, it's not too easy to float when you're bound up. You know, your hands behind you. I know you can, you know, do the dead man's float, but probably most people weren't able to do that. So, you know, I'm reminded of the, I don't know if this is a joke or not, but you know, in the medieval period, the way they tested witches was they throw them in the water. If they drowned, so they knew they were innocent. They survived. They knew they'd perform witchcraft to survive, and they killed them. Okay, leave it to the medievals. Lovely, yes. It's slightly distinct from the Jewish perspective. Okay, anyway, so he throws her into the water. Go ahead, but if.
If the husband of the woman wishes to spare his wife, and the king may in turn spare the subject.
Okay, what is this?
Is anyone in the wife's
kind? I heard an echo in the background. Certainly sounds a bit like Sota. But it's also very different. And I heard this from Yoel Ben Nun, and he's not the one who originated this. But the point here is that the Torah says, the ancient Jew says that the wife's adultery is a crime against the husband. It's up to the husband and perhaps the king to have some involvement if they want to pardon the people involved. If the husband doesn't, he basically takes them and throws them in the water. Okay? In the Torah, by the laws of Sota, so the husband does nothing. Rav Yoel, I think, went on a little diatribe when he spoke about this, about spouse abuse. That it's not a spouse's responsibility to discipline their spouse. And so the Torah says, no, you don't touch her. You don't throw her into the water. You bring her to the Kohen. Let God deal with the matter. In fact, you don't throw the woman in the water. You throw the water in the woman, and then you let God be the judge. It's clear, you can see a development. In fact, if you study Sota within Chazal, if you go back, I don't know if the Shir, my Shir is online from this, but when we did Ksuvus a couple of years ago, we developed this idea how you can see even in the Halacha, this transition, this shift from an element of crime against the husband to basically just crime against God. If you want to see just a brief, this is more agadic, Chazal have a comment on Ish Ish Kisiste Ishto Malav Omal Ish Ish Laraba Achas Isha Shalmalav Achas Isha Shalmata. Right? Her two men, her husband and her Ribono Shel Olam. In other words, it's already incorporating God. The crime of an adulterous wife is not only, and then eventually not primarily, against the husband, it's against God. Okay? David, a question? Okay. Enough of legal material for now. Just for the question earlier about what I do on the exam, I might very well take one of the laws we didn't do and ask you to take some of the principles that have come out from the Greenberg article in particular and to just comment briefly about it. You know, that's the kind of thing I very well might do. Okay. This is legal materials. There are epic materials also from Akkadian. However, I want to focus on the epic materials from from Ugarit because they are much closer to Tanakh in many ways. Mythic, the epic myth. Now, if you want to read about this, if you want to read the legends themselves, there's a volume. It seems to be impossible to buy, but the library has it. It's called Canaanite Myths and Legends. It was edited by John Gibson, I believe. It's on the fifth floor of Library and Reference. Now, there's also an important article. It's not on the syllabus. Is Suto on the syllabus? No, he's not. He's not on the syllabus. But most of the material I'm going to talk about now, about the similarities between the mythic literature of Ugarit and Tanakh in terms of literary style, are really culled from Kasuto. Because it's really almost a summary of his comments. What do we find in these... a lot of these myths are about struggles and battles between the various gods. The people from whom these myths originated were polytheists. They had a pantheon of gods. The chief god's name was El. Among his offspring, you might call it that, were Baal and Moth and Yam. And these tales, for the most part, focus on the battles and fights and goings-on between these various characters and the alliances and so on. So you will find many, if not most, of the names of pagan gods found in Tanakh. You will find them in the Ugaritic literature as well. There's a lot, the writing, I said this last week, Ugarit was very fast in deciphering because they found the lexicon. It's alphabetic in script. It has more consonants than the Hebrew language. It's got two dalets and two tufs and two ayins. It has three alephs, which are not alephs, but three, well, they're alephs, but they're vowel markers, which is interesting, because normally old scripts weren't written with vowels in them, but it has an A, E, and U, if you study the material. I'm sorry? I'm not understanding. My ears are not... Yes, they're functioning, yes, as Imot HaKriya. They are functioning, yes, as Imot HaKriya. Matres Lectiones, right. Okay, now some of the aspects of literary style that you find, if you haven't learned enough of Tanakh, you might not have noticed this in Tanakh, but one thing you find a number of places in Tanakh is the X and X plus 1 pattern. Al shlosha pishay edom v'al arba alo ashivena shesh hena sameh Hashem v'sheva tovas libo v'hakimono alav shiva roim u'shmona nisichei adam. Where you get a clause, a sentence in which you say seven or eight, or at the end of Mishle, Shloshah Hema Niflu Mimenu Yivarba Lo Yidatzim. So sometimes you get the Mefarshim will try to count three and four exactly. What this is a way of saying when you have lines in parallelism is you sometimes, if you want to say, take the pasuk in Micha, V'achemanu Olav Shiva Roim Shmona Nisichei Adam. Which is probably, you get Midrashim, who the seven Roim are, and who the eight Nesichei Adam are. Pshat is, Shiva Roim means many shepherds, many leaders. And Shmona Nesichei Adam, when you put the sentence in parallel, you take X plus one as your number. Okay? If you actually look throughout Tanakh, you will find this is a common phenomenon. Okay? In poetry, and you find the same thing. It's not something we use in English. The closest thing I can think of in Chazal, but it means really something else. You say, Mafanin arba chamisha kupos, right? And you know what the Gemara's question they always ask is: if you can move five, why do you need to tell us four, right? But in other words, that's a peculiar literary aspect. Chazal will bother by it in the context of the Mishnah, although it's not the same thing as what's going on here. But it is unusual. Yeah. Means the way the clause is set up. Shlosha hema niflu mimeni. Three things are beyond me. The arba'o lo yidatim, and four, I don't know them. Right? What does that mean? What, is he counting a total of seven things, or three, or there's a fourth thing? No. Pshat, in most cases, is there are a number of things I don't know, and there are a number of things I don't know. But the way, when you pick a number to put in there, you start with X, and then you add 1 to the next one. When the Pasuk in Micha wants to say that we will establish for them many leaders, so it says Vakemonu Allah, or we will fight back with our many leaders will fight back, Vakemonu Allah Shiva Roim Ushmona Nisichei Adam. It's not 7 specific individuals, 8 specific individuals, it means a lot of individuals. And the way you say it, right, Roim is parallel to Nisichei Adam, Shiva and Shmona.
So it's just a way of expressing many?
Yeah, well, no, the point, if a number is not necessarily specific, and it's a way you structure a parallel sentence. Okay? Look up, I'll give you the citations, you can look at them in context. If you go in Mishlei, I'm glad that you've asked me, because I found in the past students seem on their exams seem to have difficulty grasping what I'm saying. So apparently, I'm either not clear or you don't have enough background to realize this. Mishlei Vav Tezayin, Shasena Sanei Hashem B'Sheva Tovas Nafsho. Okay, 6:16. And then at the end of Mishlei, just for more examples, there. Perek Lamed. Pasuk Yurches, Pasuk Tezvav, Pasuk Chavtes.
They wanted to express a large amount of things.
The point is that when you say a number of things, so the way you express, if you, and you repeat the clause. So what you may end up doing is, and as you want to say, we will stop the pasuk in Micha. Hold on. Parak Hey. Pasuk Dalad. Okay, Vayadze Shalom, Ashur ki yavo be'arteinu, when Assyria will enter our land, v'chi yidrof ba'am anaseinu, if they'll try to trample on our palaces, v'hakemonu alav shiva roim u'shmona nisichei adam. We will set against them, to fight back against them, 7 shepherds, 7 leaders, and 8 princes of men. So what does that mean? It means a number of. And the shiva and shmona are not specific numbers, it means many, and the way you express it, and since you're repeating it, many leaders and many leaders, you say 7x and 8y. Right? No, that's just, that's a poetic convention. Okay.
The numbers aren't random, though. 7 as opposed to 3 for a reason.
Not necessarily. In other words, don't expect Lafi Pshat to find 7 specific people. We could say, I'm sure the Midrashim do that. But it's not necessarily Pshat. Okay. Another feature one finds in the Ugaritic myth, it's repetition. I remember I once wrote a paper about the Akkad epic. Akkad was a son of Dan El, whom I'll talk more about later. Dan El was a Mutu Rapui. He was one of the Misei Rifa'im. He was one of the men of the Rifa'im. If you recognize Rifa'im, you should. They were a people. And he was a man of the Rifa'im. He seems to have been this wise, judge-like figure. He didn't have a son. So he prays to Baal. And he describes a laundry list of 12 things, or X thing, I don't remember how many, that a son does for a father. Many of them mundane things. Some of them cultic, you know, ritualistic, some of them not. And then the text says that Baal brings his supplication to El, so the chief god. And Baal says, can you give Dan El a son who does? And it lists the entire thing again. And then El decides to grant Baal's request on behalf of Dan El. And then El says, I will grant him a son who will do the entire laundry list again. And then Baal comes back and pronounces for Dan El, says, oh great, now he will have a son who will do X. Okay, this is one of many examples of repetition. Can you think of any examples that strike you?
Yeah.
What's that? The Nisim is one, something even more. What's that? This week's Parsha. Right? Yofes Sichasim Shal Avde Avos Tnei Amako Mitarasim Shal Bnei Banim. Right? That many goofin in the Torah get receive nothing. You know, and the story of Eved Avraham is you know, doubled. Right? Now, that is a, it's a literary technique, a literary style. Why? Hard to know. Is it an indication of once of something that's oral in nature, oral poetry? Who knows? But it's found frequently, and you find this a lot in the Torah, things that are sort of repeated. The Tzivui and the Maisa. Okay. Vocabulary and idiomatic usage. Okay. By? Well, no. He just says, Yafasi Chasen Shal Avdei Avos. It's not an answer. I mean, it's an answer. It's a nice answer, but it like doesn't really explain things. Well, I don't know what exactly. I don't know what that means, but okay. Vocabulary and idiomatic usage. Two observations. One examples Kasuga brings. Vayisaino vayar. What does that mean? There's a Gemara about this, right? He said, "Pshot yadecha." It's in Chagiga, in the first parak. What's that? In Kabbalah Necha, right? It's in the first parak in Chagiga. That's almost like Vayisaino vayar. He picked up his eyes and you know, and he looked out. He raised up his eyes. So it's an expression to look into the distance. Now, you know that because that's obviously how you translate it. But it is idiomatic. It's found also in Ugaritic materials. Also, taking people as a migration term to take someone if you want a trip. Vayikach terach as Avram beno. We know what it means, but it's a metaphor which is also found in the Ugaritic myth. You should be aware that Unklus, when he translates taking a person, how does he translate? Udvar, which means to lead, as opposed to nisav, to take. Nisav also by kiddushin and by an object, right?
By Korach, didn't we say like each holy person separate?
Yes, but that's a unique example. That's already clear exegesis beyond literal meaning of the text, because there's a problem there. But the problem in that case is the object is missing, right? What did he take? Okay. So that's another thing that we find. Again, some of this we knew already just from reading the text, but you sort of get a verification in another, in a similar related culture where idioms are used the same way. Word phrases and pairs. Word pairs and phrase pairs, something very common in Biblical Hebrew. It's a lot of fun to study these things. When you get poetic parallelism, when you get one word in one side and another in the other, and they come together frequently. For example, kesef and charutz. I mentioned this last week. Charutz means is gold. Okay, charutz when it's in parallel to kesef. It's only found in Tanakh in parallel to kesef with this meaning. You never find charutz alone as gold. This happens to be a word pair common in Ugaritic. Kubas and kos. Kubas occurs a couple of times. We saw it in Yeshayahu in the Masoretic materials we happen to be looking at. Kubas and kos. All right, Kubas and Kos. Kubas does only appears those two places in Yeshaya in the same parak, I think, once or twice there. Kubas and Kos are a common word pair in Ugaritic. Another example is Tal and Rivivim. Okay. Yarov tamatar lechiti, and matar also some gets thrown in there. Tizal katalim rasi kisirim adesher lechir vivim aleis. You look where those words revivim occurs in Tanakh. It's usually in such a context, either matar or tal. Here's a very useful one. Something that scholars wanted to amend the biblical text in Yeshayahu until, in fact, we discovered something very interesting in Ugaritic. The Navi says,
"Tira."
Okay, what does the word tishta mean? Let's see if any of you are good with grammar. What would your first guess be? Well, before was it mean? Well, what does it mean, you think? Tishta. Tishta.
Shaka?
What's that? Shin Taf Ayin, do you know that word appears
in the
English?
No.
No. I don't know, is Shaka even a bit of a is it I know, but is that a biblical Hebrew root at all? That, not by son for sure. That's Bob, Shemesh is Bob. I'm trying to remember if Shen Kabayan is even a biblical Hebrew root. I don't remember. Offhand I can't think of anything, but that doesn't mean anything. So what does the word Tishta mean?
Impatient.
What?
Impatient.
No. I gave you enough context to figure it out. Guys, come on. Yeah, I heard it. To be afraid, right? That's what it usually means, right? The problem is, how does it mean that? So the Rishonim, I don't know what they, I don't know what they took it as, but the only way one is tempted to read that it's the short for Tishka'el. Okay? Which would be a Tishka'el.
You mean quiet?
Okay? No, which could mean to speak. It could be a Shin, this could be Shinai Yud. It could mean a shadow or something like that. It means, you know, you're mumbling out of fear or something like that. And the assumption is that, because we don't know if we're reading Tishka'el from Hebrew, so therefore, it must be Tishka'el, which makes sense grammatically. And this then being the root again, if you've learned any grammar, so you know that the Taf there is his file marker. It turns out that Shin Taf Ayin is a root in Ugaritic, which is used in parallel to fear, which means simply means to fear. And there is a root Shin Taf Ayin, like Tivne Tishta. That's the way it is. And we wouldn't have known that word. We got a general sense, but we wouldn't have known the word until this. Okay. Other things that we only know because of Ugarit. Firstly, are there Daniels here? Who are the Daniels here? Any other Daniels? How do you pronounce your Hebrew name? Help me. I'm sorry.
Don't feel bad, because as I told you, Yirmiyahu, my Hebrew name, has a schwa in the name, and I only discovered that a couple of years ago. It's not a theory. Yirmiyahu.
You sound like the Israeli pronunciation?
One second. Okay, this is the spelling of my name.
Here.
What's that? Here?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, but I thought that the man was theory. Yirmiyahu. It's not. It's Yirmiyahu. Who's volunteering?
There.
Someone's L. What did somebody else say? Somebody else said something. What? That would be nothing. Okay? Then you would have it there, Alan. You'd have it over there. But that is simply wrong.
That's not right. It's supposed to be Daniel.
That's correct. The name is Daniel. That's how it's always vocalized in Sefer Daniel. Okay. But, anybody have Tanakh here?
Yes.
Daniel. Yeah. That's how it should be pronounced. If you turn to say Perek Yudalid, Yecheskel is quoting God as saying that no matter how righteous a person is, people are so bad, they would only save themselves, they wouldn't even be able to save their children in their merit. And he says, Hayu Shloshes HaMashim HaEle B'Socha, Noach, Daniel, V'Iyov.
Daniel is spelled as follows in the text. The Dalit and it also appears in Chama. In the margins, it is written. In the margins, that's the way it's written.
Yudalit.
Yudalit, 14:14. That's a good way to remember. Okay. What's the problem? I don't care about the grammar, but I'll come back to this in a second. And also, by the way, also, later by the king of Tsor, it's in the Perek of Zion, I think, when Yechezkel had the dirge for the king of Tsor, who became all too arrogant, he says, HaChacham Ata Mi Daniel, in Chavches, Pasuk Gimel, Hinei HaChacham Ata Mi Daniel, Kol Sasum Amahufa, you think yourself wiser than Daniel. Now let me ask you a question. Who is this Daniel? Well, let's talk about why we don't think this is Daniel, the biblical figure. Because he lives probably slightly later than Yechezkel. Yechezkel is a Navi, but presumably when you choose to present the metaphor to people, a Navi does, he presents a metaphor about people they know. Placing among Noah and Eo, hoary figures of great antiquity, is a very strange choice if you're talking about Daniel or the stories in Babel. The more likely explanation for this is reflected in the original spelling in the text, which perhaps the Bali Masora did not fully understand, which is why they had us pronounce it the other way, and they would have no way of knowing, was in fact the reference to Daniel that we know of also from the Ugaritic epic myths. Even without the Ugaritic passages, you might have guessed on your own that he was some ancient wise figure. Right? Now we actually have an ancient wise figure who fits the bill with the name Daniel. Yes, Steph.
So how do we have the Gemara even that Eov lives later than this?
Nobody in the Gemara says that Eov lived later than this. No one could. No opinion says that. I don't remember what the latest is, but nobody says it dates to Baal Shem. What's that? Yeah, but that's nothing with Eov. He said about Eov. No, we know when Daniel. What's that? Who says in Baal Shem? No, can't be. That'd be a great paper to write if that were so. No. Eov bima Moshe. Eov was a mashal. And that's the famous medrash used in the days of Moshe.
And according to this medrash system, Eov actually was the scholar of that generation.
There was one sheet that says he was Me'ole Gola. So that's sort of Yechezkel's contemporary. But very problematic. I don't know if you should. I mean, someone should ask the question of either the Pasuk in Yechezkel. I mean, it's contemporary. I don't know. Okay, so maybe that, but it makes no sense. You don't need me to say it. You can read the Pasuk in Yechezkel. Yechezkel has to be citing a figure who's famous. Okay, unless Eov Me'ole Gola is a medrash that assumes, a sheet that assumes that he lived for hundreds of years or something like that.
There's a medrash that's used in his Kabbalah like seven times over.
I'm sorry?
There's a sheet that said he's in his Kabbalah 7 times over, so each of those he actually had the Tzar's spot.
Well, he lived 140 years according to the Navi. So, that certainly aligns with that, like 7 generations. Well, anyway, okay, so maybe he lived a very long time. But certainly he had to have been a famous figure by the time Yechezkel cites him as an example. And Noach is a pretty famous figure also. So here's another example of something that we wouldn't have known. We really had no way of knowing without that. Okay. Does anybody have a Sefer Tehillim? Perek Samach Tes, Pasuk Hey. Now, I'm going to tell you the following. There is an epithet that is frequently used. Well, let's go the other way. Let's read it. Go ahead. What does it say? Thank you. Who's reading for me? Anybody? Daniel, who's reading?
Shiru, Shiru, the king's army, Shimai, son of the Ruchi, Barabbas, the Pashimai, the Ilzi.
Ruchi, Barabbas?
Shimai, son of the Ruchi, Barabbas, yeah.
Barabbas.
Barabbas.
Okay. So it's part of the power of the Shiva. It means uplift or something like that. What is Rochei Va'aravot?
God.
Thank you. What does it mean?
The Rama says that the they were like the, like the spheres, like the Aravot was like the spheres or something, and God above them, you rise and not me.
What do you think it means? What? What do you think? Our woman and our chariot. Okay, we could put that down as option one.
It's like the passages producing.
What are our hopes, Ayo?
It was summer retreat, and I guess a king would ride on, I guess, a big chariot filled with like.
No, what are our hopes?
Huh?
No. Well, yes, but no. Not. What do you know our hopes to mean? Can you show me what this is in that
place?
What?
Plains.
Plains. The rider of the plains. I think that's how the King James Bible translates. Chazal said that Aravot was one of the names of the seven heavens. The reason they do so is a piece of very simple biblical exegesis. Rochev Shamayim be'ezrecha o begavaso shchakim. Say, Rochev Aravot. Chazal, in fact, were correct. Now, I know Professor Bernstein, when he tells us, when he talks about this, he says that good news is bad news. The good news is Chazal were right. Now, the bad news part, I disagree with being bad news. I think it actually just sheds light on the pasuk. The bad news that he likes to then quote is, or then he then proceeds to quote, I should say, is the following. This is a transcription. That's a symbol from Hayim. Okay? You can put in whatever vocalization you like, probably Rakabi Arkatu. Okay? Which is an epithet that appears frequently in the Ugaritic literature, a title for Baal. Does that look familiar?
No. Yeah, all right.
Yeah. You know it's backwards. K and Vase are the same sound. Okay, it's backwards. I'll reverse it for you then. I just wrote the English. I mean, that's not a secret. It's English is written the other way. Okay. It's because the people who started doing this were German scholars, so German like English is left to right. That's why we write things that way. Okay? I'm sure you can start getting drushes on what this is about me, but this is what it felt. Oh, is that good or bad? So the answer is, of course it's good. Now you understand what the Pasuk and Tehillim means. Praise the rider of the... And we know from Ugaritic, by the way, that Arachetzel means clouds. Okay, so Chazal were correct. It means in the heavens. Okay, there you go. Okay? So you're headed for a career as an archaeologist. Okay, the whole point of the Pasuk is so or okay, Baravot, because Shema. The pagan said that his name is Baal. Wrong. His name is God. I mean, the Pasuk... I think it's so obvious. It's an explicit polemical statement that Baal is nonsense and God is true. That's basically, and now you understand what the thrust of the pasuk is, which you probably didn't understand before. Yes.
So, how do you translate the word "solo"?
Solo probably means it's some form of giving praise. It may mean to. I mean, it's used elsewhere, sort of to clear away. So it probably is here also. It's like you're clearing away room for the chariot or something like that. Yeah, but he was a major god. The point this here is that there is no Baal. The point is that in the pasuk is Shiru. What's the beginning of Shiru? Shiru Shemo. Right.
The point is that Rochev Baravot is the parallel to Lelokim. Exactly your point. Elokim is based upon what name? El. There are no two different people here.
What about the rest of the apostles? They didn't actually care about them. I mean, if they were trying to get an idea, there was some other. So you're saying basically they got the idea of Baal from this pasuk?
No. The point is, this pasuk is written after the Ugaritic epic myths. The archaeological find was 14th or 15th century, which means anything in there was at least cannot be any younger than that. It has to be older than that, right? That's, in other words, a Sefer Torah written today, the text of the Torah, more or less, is, do the math, 3,500 years old, 3,300 years old. But you know that if you find the text of the Torah written today, if you found the text last week, you know it couldn't have been written later than last week, right? So the latest you can date these myths to the 14th, 15th century. Tilum is not written until hundreds of years later. But it means that there's a title that the pagans use for Baal, Rochev Aravot, and here the Meshorer is adopting that title for God and saying the only true Rochev Aravot is God, not Baal. That's all. That's what the intent of the pasuk is. In other words, Shiru Lelokim Zamru Shemo, Solu Lerochei Baravot Bekash Shemo. There's no Baal here. Okay. Last point is the following. The pasuk, I believe, is in Yishayahu in the early Mammoths. V'atein Adam Tachtecha Ulumim Tachas Nashecha. So the problem is this pasuk is not exactly parallel. I have placed man underneath you and le'umim tachas nafshecha. Le'umim are
nations.
So Adam is a little bit of a strange usage. I forget what the critics wanted to amend the text to, but it turns out that this parallel is found in Ugaritic literature as well. And nations under your soul, literally. Meaning you will dominate over them. So the point is that here was an attempt to amend the text, as, by the way, biblical scholars frequently do when they find texts that they can't understand. So one of their tools, which should always be the tool of last resort, is to amend the text to something that makes sense. That's a very tricky business. We generally like to avoid doing that. We certainly don't do it on Torah. We don't like doing it on Anach either. You can read that. If you want to see one Mefarish, Shadal, I mentioned before, he's much faster to amend, but never on Torah. That's like he draws this line between Torah and Nach. And frequently he will resort to emendations to explain a very problematic pasuk. Okay. But anyway, so that's what they wanted to do. But here's a case where what you're getting is more source material for greater data on words, which often can solve problems that we didn't know before. One book of Tanakh, by the way, the one book of Tanakh that when you learn, you need to learn with a Ugaritic dictionary in one hand is a Sefer Iyov. It is the book by far with the strangest words. Yes, is there a question?
Yeah. Do you find that the biblical poetry is repetition? Like the same idea in different words?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, yeah, that's a given. Yeah. What's that? It established the fact that Adam, and I don't remember if they have take a different meaning for the word Adam, or the fact that Adam and Le'umim are used together in parallel. So it's not a mistake. Okay. Alright, I think that's really enough for now. Next week it's going to be on to Targum. I will probably send you something to respond to during the week, and if you haven't given me your responses.